3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. Russian and Turkish officials have been trying to come up with a ceasefire in the Syrian civil war. The Turkish state Anadolu news agency, citing an official source, says a ceasefire has already been prepared, but Russian officials would not comment on the report, and rebel groups deny a truce has been agreed to. Officials are trying to expand the current Aleppo ceasefire to cover the whole country. The U.S. Embassy in Ankara issued a strong worded statement Wednesday denying claims by Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan that U.S.-led coalition forces have given support to the Islamic State group. Mr. Erdogan Tuesday accused the coalition of not only backing IS, but also backing Kurdish rebel factions operating inside and outside of Turkey. A U.S. official called Mr. Erdogan's comments ludicrous. Former Argentine President Cristina Fernandez has been indicted on charges of attempting to directing a corrupt enterprise while attempting to hide millions of dollars in a convent. Fernandez has denied the charges. A federal judge charged Fernandez and other officials of colluding to steal public funds that were meant for public road projects between 2003 and 2015. Search teams say they have found at least two flight recorders in the wreckage of a Russian aircraft that crashed into the Black Sea on Christmas Day. The Russian Defense Ministry says analysis of the data has begun. The ministry also says 15 bodies have been found so far. Actress Debbie Reynolds has died at the age of 84. Her son Todd Fisher said Reynolds died Wednesday, a day after her daughter, Carrie Fisher. He said the stress of his sister's death was too much for Debbie Reynolds. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry unveiled broad guidelines Wednesday for an eventual peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, warning a two-state solution to the conflict is in serious jeopardy. No major new proposals were included in Kerry's hour-long speech at the State Department.
The two-state solution is the only way to achieve a just and lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians. It is the only way to ensure Israel's future as a Jewish and democratic state.
Kerry defended the U.S. decision last week to abstain from a United Nations Council resolution that condemned Israeli settlements in areas claimed by the Palestinians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Wednesday called Kerry's speech a deep disappointment. In a late-night news conference, Mr. Netanyahu said the speech was as unbalanced as the UN resolution itself.
Secretary Kerry paid lip service to the unremitting campaign of terrorism that has been waged by the Palestinians against the Jewish state for nearly a century. What he did was to spend most of his speech blaming Israel for the lack of peace.
Meanwhile, the Palestinian president says he is ready to resume peace talks if Israel freezes settlement construction. U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham says Russia did interfere in the recent U.S. presidential election and can expect hard-hitting sanctions. Graham said Wednesday that in 2017, the U.S. Congress will investigate Russia's involvement in the November 8th U.S. election. The senator says he expects tough new sanctions against Russia to get bipartisan support, and he said sanctions could target President Vladimir Putin personally.
It is now time for Russia to understand enough is enough.
Russia has denied allegations that President Putin was personally involved in the hacking. President-elect Donald Trump announced Wednesday that two telecommunications companies are adding thousands of jobs to the U.S. economy.
Because of what's happening and the spirit and the hope, I was just called by the head people at Sprint, and they're going to be bringing 5,000 jobs back to the United States. They're taking them from other countries. They're bringing them back to the United States.
Trump gave no details and did not say if he or his transition team had anything to do with the new jobs. White supremacist Dylan Roof, who murdered 9 black worshipers at a Charleston, South Carolina church, has told a judge he does not plan to call any witnesses or present any evidence in the penalty phase of his trial, which is upcoming. Roof faces the death penalty, but he has fired his attorneys and will act as his own lawyer. A jury convicted Roof of 33 counts of hate crimes and obstruction of justice earlier this month. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan lawmakers move cautiously on a contentious electoral bill ahead of 2017 polls.
Certain clarities have to be highlighted, Mr. Speaker, because there has been extraordinary sacrifices and discussions that have been going on between the two sides of this house.
Kithure Kindiki is the Senate Majority Leader of Kenya. A once prominent South Sudanese lawyer talks about life as a refugee in Kenya. One of the protesters freed recently by the Ethiopian government will discuss a government-sponsored training to reform protesters and bring back our girls' movement, Wish Freedom, for the remaining Chibok girls.
Our wish in terms of Chibok girls is before 2017, all Chibok girls are rescued. Everybody in captivity is brought back home. Because we always know that the fight for Chibok girls is the fight for the soul of Nigeria.
Aisha Yesufu is a member of the Bring Back Our Girls movement. Outgoing U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Powell, will discuss a number of hot conflict areas around the world. And an ancient Chinese herb helps fight against tuberculosis. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Kenya, a controversial amendment to the electoral law is now before the Senate. The bill would give the Electoral Commission a workaround if biometric voting equipment fails. But the opposition has rejected the change for fear of voter fraud. As political temperatures rise ahead of next year's polls, Senate members are advising caution and careful consideration. Mohammed Yusuf has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
The Senate did not vote on the amendment to the electoral law Wednesday. Instead, Senate Speaker Ikwa Ithuru sent the bill to committee.
The Standing Committee on Legal Affairs and Human Rights must therefore proceed with dispatch and be ready to table its report on 4th January 2017, when the Senate is expected to assemble for the special sitting.
Wednesday's proceedings in the Senate were remarkably sober compared to the chaos last week in the lower house. Debate on the bill descended into fistfights on the parliament floor and a walkout by opposition members before the vote. The proposed change will allow the Electoral Commission to manually identify voters and transmit results if biometric voting kits fail. A move, the opposition say, is one way of rigging the election. Opposition Senate member Amos Wako welcomed the move by the Speaker to refer the matter to the committee.
I feared that the cardinal principle which underlies our constitution, participation by the people in whom the sovereignty of Kenya lies, may be curtailed or shortened just to meet the deadline that this bill must be passed today. I'm glad that through a consultative approach and so on, we have come now to a place where the committee will be given some time.
The opposition has threatened to protest and even boycott next year's nationwide elections if the electoral law is changed. The rising tensions have sparked concern in Kenya, where post-election violence in 2007 and 2008 killed 1,300 people and uprooted 300,000 more from their homes. Senate Majority Leader Kithure Kindiki says the committee has to look at the issue with a lot of care.
Certain clarities have to be highlighted, Mr. Speaker, because there has been extraordinary sacrifices and discussions that have been going on between the two sides of this house since this matter started polarizing our country to a level of almost tearing us apart. This is an issue that even as the committee, in my view, looks at it, must be looked in that context.
MPs in the lower house say the request to change the law was made by the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC. Political commentator Martin Andati blames the electoral body for the current political crisis.
The political will is not there. Once IEBC encountered those challenges, they should have reached out to both sides of the political divide and told them we are having a problem here. So from that perspective, they should have also given possible solutions, so that when you go and meet the leadership of CORD and the leadership of Jubilee, then you are able to hammer out consensus. And it's on the basis of that deal that you'll take those amendments to Parliament.
He says the perception of a unilateral change by one side will foster suspicion, potentially casting doubt on the election results and even leading to violence. The opposition had pledged to take to the streets to protest the bill starting January 4th. It is not clear if this latest move in the Senate will make them postpone a decision. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
In Nigeria, a member of the Bring Back Our Girls movement says the group is praying for the rescue of the remaining Chibok girls from Boko Haram captivity before the end of the year. But Aisha Yesufu says if the girls are not freed by January 8, the 1,000th day of their captivity, the group will continue to fight for their release. This comes after reports say a group of 21 Chibok girls brought home to Chibok for Christmas were not allowed to celebrate the holiday with their families. A spokesman for President Muhammadu Buhari, Garba Shehu, reportedly said the officers assigned to protect the girls misunderstood their instructions, but Yesufu wonders what other instructions are being misunderstood when it comes to the government's efforts to rescue the remaining Chibok girls.
We did hear that the 21 girls that were taken to Chibok were not allowed to go visit their families and also were not allowed to go worship in the various churches on Christmas Day and all that. They were kept in a particular home of a politician. Maybe because of security issues, that's the reason why they were not taken home. But first of all, one thing we need to understand is the fact that there are 23 Chibok girls that have been found, not 21. So first of all, they need to be together. If they're going back home, all 23 of them should be going back home. So for 21 to go and two are not accounted for, it's a little bit worrisome.
But Aisha Garba Shehu, President Buhari's spokesperson, that there was some misunderstanding on the part of the security people that are protecting the girls. They misunderstood perhaps their instructions.
Well, first of all, it is very unfortunate for Garba Shehu to come out and say that there was misunderstanding of the instructions that were given to the security agencies that took the girls to the village. At this stage, we should not be having misunderstanding of information. Information should be explicitly given and in terms that it's well understood. Even before they left Abuja, we're in a situation where we have 196 of our Chibok girls. They are not yet back. If instructions to take the girls home and celebrate Christmas with their parents is being misunderstood, what the other instructions are being misunderstood in the rescue of our Chibok girls?
Aisha, President Muhammadu Buhari has, what I would say, congratulated the Nigerian military or the security forces who are engaged in the fight against Boko Haram, specifically for their effort to dislodge Boko Haram from their main hideout in the Sambisa forest. Although he also said that the government is not going to rest until they've rescued the rest of the Chibok girls.
For us, that is what we expect from our government. That is what we expect from President Muhammadu Buhari. We do remember that during his inaugural speech, President Muhammadu Buhari did say that the war against Boko Haram would not be said to have been won without the rescue of our Chibok girls and all other abductees. And we hold him to his words. And he himself knows he is accountable for his words and he's keeping that promise. And we would not relent on demanding for our Chibok girls to be rescued. On the Sambisa issue and the fact that we have been able to get back Sambisa, it's a welcome development. And we thank the military. The soldiers at the war front have always been our heroes.
As Bring Back Our Girls movement, as we get ready to enter a new year, 2017, what's your organization's wish in terms of the Chibok girls?
Our wish in terms of Chibok girls is before 2017, all Chibok girls are rescued. Everybody in captivity is brought back home. In the meantime, if our Chibok girls are still not back, we get to 2017, we continue what we always done. Our Chibok girls are our daughters. We might not have carried them in our wombs, but we see them as our daughters, and we cannot allow our daughters to be taken away by terrorists and will not go and look for them and bring them back home. January 8, 2017, will be 1,000 days, just 11 days from now, that our Chibok girls would have been in captivity. And definitely on that day, we'll be marking that day and the week after that.
Aisha, thank you very much again for speaking with us, and Happy New Year to you.
Same to you. Thank you so much.
Aisha Yusufu is a member of the Bring Back Our Girls movement. She was speaking with me from Abuja, Nigeria. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Thursday, December 29th. Let's send shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Brilla FM in Nigeria. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A South Sudanese activist and lawyer says life in exile is difficult. Samuel Dong Luog says since fleeing South Sudan in 2013 and taking refuge in Kenya, he has had to struggle to provide for his family. Dong tells John Tanza of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program that he fled the country because his life was in danger.
I left South Sudan in August, the 10th of 2013. I came by air from Juba to Nairobi. What caused me to leave the country was the case against the chairman of the SPLM, President Salva Kiir, when we represented Pagana Moom, who was by then the Secretary General of the SPLM. And we petitioned the Supreme Court of South Sudan because the chairman of the SPLM violated the constitution of South Sudan by preventing Pagana Moom, the Secretary General of the SPLM, from traveling or even talking or speaking. So we felt that these are fundamental freedoms and they are enshrined into the constitution of South Sudan, and nobody should really prevent any citizen from exercising them. And as the case progresses, I received threat and I decided to leave the country.
When you left the country, you came to Nairobi. How is life in Nairobi? I know you're somebody who is used to making your own money and putting food on the table for your family. How is life for you in Nairobi?
Life, of course, was difficult and still very difficult because I used to generate some income when I was practicing in South Sudan. But at the moment, I don't do anything. I have family to take care of, school fees, and so other many expenses. So it's really, really difficult. But when I first came, I was supported by the Human Rights Defenders and other organizations for almost 1 year. And then later on, they stopped the support. So we are struggling like any other refugee to make a living. We get support sometimes from our relatives who are abroad. They can send you some money. But it's difficult, very, very difficult.
And how do you feel? How do you really feel? Because your country is just 1 hour flight from Nairobi. If you're driving, it's a matter of... How do you feel? Do you feel like you want to go back home?
Yeah, I really feel that I want to go back home. But of course, John, as a human being, you need to have some freedoms in your own country. If those freedoms are not there, then you better stay or exile yourself because... without freedom of expression, freedom of associations, freedom of enjoying your life as a citizen of that particular country, then it doesn't make any sense. People in South Sudan now, they don't enjoy their freedoms. You know, they meet death every day. You know, I sympathize with those people who are living in South Sudan. Even though my life is difficult here, but they are living the most difficult life in South Sudan.
Samuel Dong Luak is a South Sudanese activist, lawyer, and now a refugee in Kenya. He was speaking to John Tanza in Nairobi. Ethiopia has released thousands of protesters who were detained during the ongoing state of emergency. Befakadu Hailu is a member of a group known as the Zone 9 bloggers. They were acquitted last year of charges of inciting violence under Ethiopia's anti-terrorism law. But he was rearrested in October after an interview with VOA's Amharic service. Hailu spoke to VOA's Salim Solomon from Addis Ababa shortly after his release.
During my interrogation in Yeka Police, they mentioned interview that I have given for the Voice of America Amharic program. They said that I have said bad things about the state of emergency, bad things in Amharic. But different people were accused of different things. For example, there were many, many teachers from high schools. They don't know what they did exactly, but most of the teachers think that it is what they spoke during teachers' meeting during the beginning of the year.
Were you able to have contacts with family members or your lawyers? What were conditions like?
In a Warsh Sabbat training center, we didn't have any access to either family and friend visitors or to lawyers. So we didn't have any contact to the outside world, or didn't even have any access to any information other than news that's broadcasted on the national TV. Even the news, we have watched it for the last 10 days only.
We just heard thousands of people were released from prisons and different places that used to be military camps. If you have to paint a picture for me to understand what these places look like, what was it like?
In our seven, we were about 1,180 people. We were training there. 243 of us were taken from Addis Ababa. The rest, 933 of us, were brought from different Oromia areas. The training started just after 24 hours we arrived at our 7.
What kind of training are they giving you?
There were 6 modules. The first one is about the current protest. It speaks a lot about the economical progress that Ethiopia is registering, and the document claims that the current protests are not supposed to happen in a country. That the second module was about color revolutions, and it claims that the current protest is an attempt of undergoing color revolution, which is, according to the document, sponsored by neoliberals that wanted to have a domestic market in Ethiopia. Then the rest 4 are about some issues in Ethiopian history. Then the next one, the 4th one, is about the Ethiopian constitution. And the 5th one is about what they call Ethiopian Renaissance and the fight to combat poverty. And the last module is about the role of the youth in building our country.
B. Fekadu Hailu is a member of a group known as the Zone 9 bloggers. He spoke with Viewer Salim Solomon from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power has dealt with some of the world's worst conflicts since taking her post in August 2013. Although her term comes to an end with the installation of a new U.S. administration, the Irish-American writer, reporter, and diplomat is as busy as ever. Powell discussed some of the most pressing current global issues with VOA earlier this month after the UN Security Council approved new sanctions against North Korea for its relentless pursuit of nuclear weapons. Zlatika Hoek reports.
North Korea has been under UN sanctions since 2006 for its illicit nuclear and ballistic missile tests, but it has persisted in building nuclear arms. Power told VOA the new sanctions will close some of the loopholes of the previous ones, but much will depend on how well they are implemented by China, North Korea's main benefactor.
My sense is that they find 2 nuclear tests in a calendar year extremely destabilizing. They see the steps that responsible nations like the United States, Korea, Japan have to take in terms of our deterrence, in terms of military exercise to prepare because of the provocations and the illegal actions of the North Korean regime. And I think they are very sincere in wanting the denuclearization of the peninsula.
During her term as U.S. envoy in the World Organization, Power was involved in seeking solutions for war-torn Syria. The latest UN proposal to create an autonomous zone in rebel-controlled eastern Aleppo has been flatly rejected by the Syrian government, whose forces are now carrying out brutal attacks on the area.
The air attacks by the Syrian regime, aided by the Russian Federation, are going to stain the conscience of those countries who carried them out, stain history, and they will be something that people will speak about generations hence as defining actions by President Assad and by President Putin.
power said the conflict in Syria can only end through a negotiated process.
They can take a populated area, even one as substantial as eastern Aleppo, inflict horrific human carnage, and the war will not end. If anything, you will have more people who will be eager to take up arms against the regime. What will end the war is a political solution.
Power also has been engaged in UN efforts to end the ethnic violence in South Sudan.
We are urging Security Council members to act quickly to impose an arms embargo in order to change at least one dimension of the South Sudanese government's actions, which is their propensity for choosing armed systems over food for their people.
Power's term as UN ambassador ends early next year when the new Republican administration takes over. Zlatis Ahok, VOA News, Washington.
Scientists have found that a drug used to treat malaria may also help fight tuberculosis, which infects one-third of the world's population. The ancient Chinese herb, Artemisinin, has the potential to shorten how long it takes to treat TB, something that could also slow drug resistance to antibiotics. VOA's Jessica Burma reports.
Scientists don't know by how much artemisinin might shorten the length of TB treatment in humans, but research in the test tube suggests that it could have a significant impact. That's because although active infections do respond to treatment, the bacterium that causes tuberculosis can lie dormant for years, a state in which it's largely resistant to antibiotics. That's why it takes 6 months or more to treat the disease. Now, researchers at Michigan State University have discovered that artemisinin, a mainstay of malaria treatment, keeps the pathogen that causes TB from becoming dormant. Microbiologist Robert Abramovich, a TB expert, says that's because many people who start taking antibiotics begin to feel better in a few days. As the active microbes are killed, they stop taking their pills, potentially creating antibiotic-resistant TB strains.
It's the dormant bacteria that take a long time to kill. So if we can kill the dormant bacteria with, say, the artemisinin or some of the other compounds we discovered, we can maybe shorten the course of therapy, and by doing that, we can reduce the sorts of clinical behaviors that are driving the evolution of drug-resistant strains.
The finding was published in the journal Nature Chemical Biology. Abramovich says TB bacteria need oxygen to thrive. To fight the infection, the body's immune system lowers oxygen levels. To protect themselves, the bacteria goes dormant. By disrupting the microbe's oxygen sensor with artemisinin and five other compounds the team discovered, it doesn't sense the lower oxygen level, remains active, and can be killed by the antibiotics. Until now, scientists couldn't see the silent bacteria to know whether it was being destroyed by different compounds. Abramovich and colleagues developed a strain of the pathogen that glows bright green. They found latent mycobacterium stopped glowing, presumably dying when they came in contact with artemisinin. Again, Robert Abramovich.
So we would also see this as an add-on to current therapies, as a way to kill another subpopulation of the bacteria during the infection.
Abramovich envisions artemisinin being used with the drug isoniazid, the first antibiotic used for the treatment of tuberculosis. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for this Thursday, December 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Nelson Lopez, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good Thursday.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.